Paul.
All right. So good to be back here at KITP. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me back, and also for the course participants for inviting me. So I gave this sufficiently vague title because I wasn't sure what I was going to talk about. By way of environmental change, at least, I can start with describing kind of the major interest that I have, that my research group has, in environmental change at many different so-called levels of biological organization and how this would impact viruses. So I begin with this kind of busy diagram where one could be concerned with real proximate mechanisms of what a virus encounters when it is out there in the harsh world and trying to make a living, even if they're not living. The point is that you can look at very kind of proximate virus-cell interactions and how, say, viruses evolve to try and keep pace with change in binding proteins that they use on cell surfaces, that kind of thing. So we're interested in those very molecular and cellular level questions. There are different types of environmental challenges when viruses find themselves in, say, the wrong tissue type or a tissue type they're not ideally suited to. So we're interested in how viruses move between tissue types. And some of the experiments we do sort of utilize tissue types or species genotypes as host shift environments. So we're interested in how viruses move between hosts at that level. Host biology is something that I find very intriguing, especially innate immunity. So we're looking at the ability of viruses to escape innate immune function. And questions like, can a virus generalist evolve if it can find key nodes in the network of innate immunity across cell types and therefore gain an advantage in emergence success? Then increasing complexity would be if you consider viruses that necessarily have hosts, such as those that are vector transmitted by organisms such as mosquitoes going between mammalian hosts. And finally, at the level of ecosystem change, things like climate change, global warming, changing average pH of the ocean, we find those sorts of environmental challenges also intriguing and how viruses might be able to cope with those or not. So the or not part...
There's something wrong with your mouth.
Is there?
It's my Helsinki is like somewhere in Poland.
Given my poor geography, however, my disclaimer is I didn't create the map. That's funny. I show that map all the time, and that's the first time anybody has ever said anything about it. I will talk to my cartographer.
Barcelona is close to Casablanca.
It's supposed to be like climate shift.
Yeah, this attentive audience. Can't get anything by yet. Okay, moving on. So the question is, how are you going to ask all those questions with a single virus system? And you're not. So we do not ask them with a single virus system. Instead, we look at many different flavors of viruses. If you consider across the top these different so-called flavors of viruses by their mode of genetic inheritance across generations, we happen at this point to be actually using systems that span the entirety of those possibilities. So today I was asked to talk about phages, and I'll focus a lot on experiments with phage 5-6, which infects bacteria. So it's a bacteriophage. Obviously, it's got to infect bacteria. It happens to infect pseudomonads, especially those that are growing on plants, especially legumes such as white clover. So we do, I think everything I'll show you today is pretty much in vitro experiments, but we have done some searching for viruses on clover plants because we expect to find these types of viruses infecting the bacteria on the plants. Some double-stranded DNA virus work that we're doing with phage PPO1, I won't talk about that today, but that's essentially a phage therapy candidate for E. coli 015787. We've done experimental evolution with it. And an ssDNA virus that we use is phage M13. You may or may not be familiar with filamentous phages, which are used for all sorts of interesting applications. And again, there we're looking at those viruses evolving on E. coli. And in terms of single-stranded RNA, both positive and negative sense, we use several viruses that are arthropod-borne viruses or arboviruses that are transmitted by mosquitoes. And Syndus virus is one that we started working on. You may never have heard of that one. It does cause some disease effects in humans, especially particular strains of it, but not that often. Dengue virus is undoubtedly something that you have heard of, so we're starting to do experimental evolution with that. But for a much longer period of time, I've been working on VSV, which is a real workhorse of molecular virology and is a negative sense RNA virus. As a note, some things that we're venturing into now are actually putting these viruses into whole mosquitoes to examine more of the interaction with the vector biology itself. Okay, so that's how we can kind of address those many different questions that I laid out. That's because we're not married to any one particular system. Here's a rough outline for what I may be able to talk about, depending on the questions from the audience. So I want to give a little bit of a, it's not really a background, just sort of the flavor for how you do phage experiments, especially if it's not terribly familiar to you. Most of the talk will focus on experimental evolution I've done with a segmented RNA phage, 5-6, and I chose to work with it for a reason, because I was intrigued by influenza virus and the evolutionary assortment in influenza viruses. So you can think of this as a very easy model system to just examine the evolutionary potential and adaptation of segmented RNA viruses. I'll go back to some very old data from the late 1990s and some experiments I did that involved game theory and kind of give you a brief update on that. But I'll focus a lot on this, which I think was the overall subject matter of the course in the last few weeks, survival and reproduction. Here I'll talk about the trade-off of improving survival versus reproduction and how it may be difficult for viruses to achieve both. And I hope to have enough time to talk about phage therapy. So if somebody says you can't do experiments on humans, that is true unless they consent to have experiments done on them. So we have somehow stumbled into the area of experimental phage therapy in humans because of patients who have run out of other options. So I'll talk to you about that, but that's very confidential stuff and it won't ultimately end up in the taped version of the talk. Okay, so phage experiments to begin with. Very familiar to this audience. I had to list it anyway. A lot of good reasons to pick RNA viruses and especially RNA phages to do experimental evolution work. High mutation rate, large population size, short generation time, adds up through population genetics to rapid evolution. Small genome size makes it affordable to look exhaustively across the genome about what happened and to do phenotype-genotype interactions. And the indefinite freezer storage is something that we rely on, that we create our own fossil record. We can go back and forth in time, if you will, to examine evolved strains and, ancestral strains and their evolved derivatives. Okay? So just a little bit of quick background on how do you visualize phage growth without using something like an electron microscope. So amazing to me is that we really use techniques that were developed in the 30s and 40s, and they really haven't had to advance very much since then. A lot of it involves taking some phage, taking some bacteria, mixing them together, and you can control how many phages there are, how many viruses there are relative to cells. That's what this is showing you. So in this example, the multiplicity of infection or the ratio of viruses to cells is a very low number, ensuring that pretty much all of those viruses will infect only a single cell on their own. You then take this and add what's called a molten agarose overlay that allows the bacteria to move out within it, and the phage will diffuse even easier. And the point is you can then visualize on top of the hard agar surface in the soft agar overlay something called phage plaques. So each one of these little circles in this picture, they differ and they're producing different colored plaques. But each of these are initiated by a single virus infecting a bacterium on this lawn, and then the progeny spread out and they infect neighboring bacteria and you get a hole in the lawn. It's called a plaque and it has live virus in it for you to obtain. Yeah.
Is there a reason you use the boring instead of spreading on the pitch? What advantage?
Right.
Three-dimensional.
So you have to use soft agar that's porous for things to be able to move through it and for the so it's kind of complicated. I may talk about it a little bit, but you have to think about rather than the bacteria growing in the surface on a mound, they're growing sort of in a sphere, okay? And as the phage move through, they encounter these spheres that are growing, they hit them and they start to cause cell destruction and form plaques. But it's basically porous enough that you can have stuff move around in it as opposed to hard agar, which is less porous. Okay? Anything else?
It's really swimming agar.
Yes, exactly. Swimming agar, where is it? There it is. Is even less dense than what we call sloppy agar or overlay agar. So that's the old school method. More novel methods are to do things like use a liquid handling robot and conjunction with other kind of fancy equipment like a microplate reader, and to do things that useful for the phage biology and harnessing what can be easily done for the bacteria. So I'll describe how this would be done. So you could take, say, 96 well plates and use a liquid handling robot to handle them in the laboratory, and then occasionally you can take those plates, put them into this machine, which basically gives you growth curves over a period of time that you allow the plate to be in that machine with a ridiculous amount of redundancy, for instance, taking measurements like every 5 seconds, literally, on a whole set, the entire plate of 96 populations. And that can give you very high resolution growth curves for your bacteria. Well, what is that going to do for you for the phage? Well, in the background, if you will, what you can't see is that these bacteria can be happily growing, and you're tracking that through the density of the cells over time. And invisible to you is that the phage that might be in that well of a 96-well plate are infecting the bacteria and going through rounds of replication, not overall affecting the growth visible to you or to the machine, but then eventually they catch up with the bacteria and cause them to go extinct, especially if the bacteria are completely sensitive. So the way to do that is, here's kind of this old school method where the phage are too small to be counted directly. You can measure phage fitness by tracking the host. Yes, I'll show you that in a minute. So the example is, here's the wild type causing an open or a clear plaque. And this mutant, I'll just tell you, is a deleterious mutant. It forms a blue plaque. So if you wanted to look at the fitness of those two strains, you would do some experiments plating them and then harvesting the whole plate. Because remember that each of these plaques has billions of individual particles in it. And then you can sort of dilute and replate after that has happened, and it tells you what's the change in the relative ratio in some time. Well, what you could do instead is track the growth curves of the bacteria, and by measuring the growth curves of the bacteria, it tells you something about the fitness of the phage that are in the well with it. So essentially strong host growth, meaning that a longer time that the host is caused to be to go extinct in the well, or a higher maximum OD that it achieves in the time allowed, would indicate that your phage is pretty wimpy, okay? And it gives you very poor destruction of the bacteria. So key time points would be this max OD and when it occurs, and some inflection point that tells us the extinction time. Those two measurements are highly correlated, and the point is, here the wild-type virus really wallops the bacteria, and here this deleterious mutant does not.
But okay. they both still go extinct, both bacteria.
Correct. Extinct.
So just a change in dynamics.
Correct. Which would matter over time, you know, in some scenarios about who is going to have on average more progeny and reach more cells. Those that are killing bacteria faster will initiate the next infection cycle faster and should gain an advantage. That makes sense? So one can simulate this using theory, and I won't really walk you through that. You can look at our 2012 paper if you want. But the point is, if you sort of take the experimental results that I just showed you, measuring the peak and the extinction time, and you look at that relative to other ways that we can measure growth rate of the phage, it's highly correlated. So at least in this system that I'm going to talk about, it works very well. I wanted to go through all that because in a moment I'll talk about the prisoner's dilemma experiment and how this kind of higher throughput method allowed us to get better insight into exactly what the mechanism was for cheating in that experiment. Okay, so now the bulk of the talk is studies of experimental evolution in 5-6. I'll try and say as little as possible because I could say a lot about this phage. It's kind of weird. It's a weird phage in the sense of it belongs to a family of phages that have characteristics much more akin to viruses and eukaryotes and not to the other known phage world. So the double-stranded RNA genome alone is wacky, so it belongs to the family of virus phages that are double-stranded RNA, and we don't know of any others. It has a lipid envelope, and that is weird because you see that in viruses of, say, animals, but you don't see it in the phage world, and it's segmented. Okay, so here's a map of the genome. It has a large, a medium, and a small segment, and these genes are fairly well described and kind of interesting how they're modular. They have different functions according to these segments that they reside on. The virus, when it infects the bacteria, is a strictly lytic infection. And something I want to point out is that the virus particles are thought to attach to these pili, which allow these plant pathogenic bacteria to adhere to leaf surfaces. and to move across the leaf and eventually into the stomata and cause an infection in the plant. So that's obviously a highly conserved and important thing for the host to have, and the viruses have evolved to cue in on that as an attachment mechanism. Once they get in, they will instruct the cell metabolism to make more virus progeny. It's a strictly lytic virus, except for a caveat that I'll talk about in a while, and they can go on and infect new cells.
What's the burst size approximately?
Approximately between 150 and 200 particles per cell for a fairly typical wild type strain of the virus. Okay, so we've done,
Paul?
Yeah.
You have a question?
Yeah.
So how long does it take?
Longer than some other phage, about 3 hours total. Okay, so the champion of that happens to occur in maybe 20 minutes or 30 minutes, different phage types. But in this system, it takes about 3 hours.
So I was actually reading before.
Oh,
sorry. So in the previous slide, so you talked about the, I guess, time to extinction maximal
right.
OD of the period, but presumably another interesting thing in that play is how much virus is or phage is left.
Right.
So is there some modern quick way of assessing that?
Quantitative PCR. Oh. And those who are grimacing agreed that it's modern and quick, but it's not easy. So we are trying to take extreme shortcuts that are valid shortcuts, so that's where this comes in. But I can tell you that we've verified things such as going into the well and figuring out this is where this kind of comes into play. You can enumerate the viruses through the old school method. You can take the sample and put it on quantitative PCR and see if you're correct, and at least in this system it's correct. Okay. Any other questions? So I guess I did enough to introduce that. And here's really why I started working on the virus in Lin Chow's lab, is back in the mid-90s, late 90s, I was interested in the role of sex in virus evolution. So especially at that time, maybe less so now, people were talking a lot about, well, historically, people have always been interested in the role of genetic variation and how it could be created aside from mutation alone, right? And whether that can accelerate adaptation. So I started working with this virus to address questions like that. And the real shorthand of it, I can tell you, is that we looked at this question using something that we could manipulate in the lab very easily. Either allow the viruses to evolve under clonal infection or low MOI, multiplicity of infection, or to evolve under high co-infection or high MOI. Okay, and that's illustrated here very simply, where a single virus gets in and all the progeny are more or less identical to it, barring spontaneous mutation. But under co-infection, you can have these two very unrelated phages get in, swap segments, and create hybrids. I don't want to forget to say that at least in 5-6, this is very clean, meaning that if there's any recombination inside the cell between homologous segments, it's happening at too low of a rate to detect. So you can think of this as a simple three locus population genetics problem. Okay, so that's very convenient. Okay, so the take home message of when we did that experiment is that we were surprised that the viruses which experienced this environment, we assumed that on top of the mutations that they would ordinarily experience in the system, it would get additional variation brought about through formation of hybrids, and it could accelerate the rate of adaptation. Maybe it wouldn't matter much, and it wouldn't necessarily accelerate it, but we certainly didn't think it would be a detriment, and it ended up being a detriment. So the co-infecting viruses became less fit than the ancestor, but only in this environment which they had not recently experienced. Okay, so they evolved to love co-infection, and they did very poorly under clonal infection. You with me on that? Okay, why? That's because cheating is possible in viruses, not just phages. This is shown in other systems, but we were a bit naive to it when we were doing the experiments. So here's a hypothetical wild-type virus showing you more of the details of this phage creating all the juicy bits and pieces inside of the cell that create progeny. And here's a wimpy one that gets in. It's not as good at doing that, so it's a hypothetical cheater because under co-infection, it becomes overrepresented in the next generation compared to what you'd expect it to be. And that's because there's no ownership rights over these juicy bits and pieces. They could use a better replicase, they could use better proteins, they could use hypothetically anything to gain an advantage and would go to their advantage. So cheaters could be advantaged following co-infection, especially evolution under high levels of co-infection, where they could adopt this trait. Okay? So here's where,
So how does that sort of compare to sort of exposing recessive mutations, right?
Right.
So, and then the high MOI case, there might be always sort of functional versions.
Yeah.
Putting around.
So your question relates more to a whole other body of work that I'm not going to talk about, where we looked at robustness. Because essentially this is a built-in robustness mechanism in this system where deleterious or low-fit viruses would be not purged as quickly from the population if co-infection is allowed. Does that make sense?
So the slide previous to this, you're assuming that all sorts of different kinds of reassortments are possible, that there's no selective pressure to reassort in certain habits.
One could naively assume that. It didn't matter. We charged full ahead into the black box and said if they are allowed to reassort, which we proved that they could.
Right. The patterns that are allowed where other patterns may not be.
So if you're asking, can there be sort of skewed ratios of observed reassortants based on, yes, that is true. For the sake of what I talk about today, it's not too important, but we can talk about it.
But you expect to have distribution of your MOIs, so probably pushed on.
Right.
And so you have both kinds of infection going on, and maybe little of the high MOI infection and more of the low MOI infection. That's kind of a physiological situation.
So we used MOI of 5, and you're correct that that creates a Poisson distribution where we are increasing the probability of co-infection, but we are not saying that 5 viruses always enter a cell. So in other words, it's a conservative way of examining the problem.
But in principle, if you have both situations happening, then you may have actually some sort of beneficial reassortment coming, rare beneficial reassortments from the co-infection, and then they kind of get selected in the clone infection.
Actually, that is a detail of it that is very true. You can think of it more realistically as every 5th generation, we allow these populations to reassort. And the other time, they were growing clone on plates. So it was actually an even more conservative way of examining it than it just.
So if you found that kind of co-infecting viruses were kind of more fit at high MOI, and you're saying that that's because of this cheating possibility, I mean, a portion of that might be because of, increased variation, right? So can you tease apart those effects?
What kind of variation?
So you know, where you came into this project, right? Asking is, does co-infection accelerate adaptation? Your answer was going to be yes because it's going to last sex, right?
Correct.
So presumably what you found was that, well, you have this cheating evolved, which gives it a benefit, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what the effect of actually sex was on actually accelerating adaptation.
Exactly.
And can you?
Yes. So it became an example of, it's important to measure the fitness of organisms in the environment in which you evolved them. And if you don't do that, you can miss it, right? So if we just said, I'll show you in a minute how we measured the fitness of everybody in both high and low MOI environments. These always increased, no matter what. There was no liability to seeing only this environment to doing well in the other one, but it was not bidirectional. So here, there was something about this environment that caused them to adopt a strategy that did not help them in the other environment.
Of course, another thing that could happen is outcrossing depression, right? Recombination low.
Yes.
We were just talking about
this. Correct.
And I don't quite understand, so the next slide, right, with cheating. So I don't see any reassortment in black and red.
Yeah, this actually is a slide that was grabbed from trying to make the point about complementation. So you're correct that it's not showing the reassortment. Rather, I usually use this slide to emphasize that there's a lot more going on than naively assuming that reassortment is the only thing that matters. So inside of the cell, there's a hell of a lot of other shit going on, like complementation, that could override any benefit of the reassortment. Now, to answer your question about recombination or reassortment load, there is not enough reassortment to invoke that. It's like a driver of the system that they adopt a bad fitness at the end because we're just forcing them into it. It's not that much.
Something. So once you have this co-infection by black and red, and you shake them and all their parts fall out, and then you package them together, you don't expect them to come out unless there is
unless there's ownership,
right?
Which do exist,
right? Unless they don't fit together, and your hybrids are not viable.
Correct. So a lot of what, again, I'm giving it to you historically, as we did this by entering a black box and didn't think about. Well, I mean, Lynn and I thought a lot about M-stasis at the time, I shouldn't really say that. But indeed, there's a lot of genetic interaction that could be happening between the segments that's biasing which ones would be in the background of each other that we just said, okay, it's part of the environment. Okay. I don't know if that's answering your question or not. But I think I'll get to it in a couple of slides.
I'll let you move on.
Eventually, you have to eat. Yes.
So another way of looking at it is, even if without the good virus, the wimpy viruses may survive better at high MOI, because they get multiple chances to infect the cell.
No, only if they're getting a benefit from each other.
But how do you measure? I mean, you're looking at the decay in these viruses.
What do you mean the decay?
Well, I mean, how do you measure that you have kind of your decay in the bad virus or the less good viruses?
By doing fitness measurements the old school way is what we published, and so I'll show you some very recent data using the high throughput method. I mean, you literally can take strains that you can tell them apart by their plaque morphology and absolutely mix them with themselves as controls. Under high and low MOI, you can mix them with any old genotype you want as long as you can tell them apart somehow. And it'll tell you absolutely which one has a replication or a reproduction advantage relative to another one in whatever environment you want to measure it. Does that make sense?
Right, but I'm just saying if you have multiple infections, you have more chances of the virus persisting anyway.
Not really seeing that. Well, but there's multiple infections throughout the whole thing. It's a serial passage experiment. So we come in as the hand of God eventually and take a subsample that is a healthy number, like 10,000 particles, and seed the next day, and they grow up to the billions and trillions, and then they undergo that bottleneck. But there's always the possibility of an infection. I feel like you're talking a little bit more about, like, if you have metapopulation dynamics where you can have, say, cheaters being transiently successful, if the high co-infection environment is happening locally, then they'll be sustained, but then if things change, then that dynamic will change.
We should probably move on.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So I want to fly through this because it's not that hard. This is a payoff matrix. You read it by, here's the strategy on the left, encountering the strategy at the top of the column. By definition, two cooperators interact, they get a fitness of one. A cheater, by definition, gets an advantage when it has a sucker to interact with. So it's getting an S2 advantage. The cooperator pays the cost of that. And a cheater, when it interacts with another cheater, doesn't have anybody to cheat against, and the assumption is that they pay a fitness cost by adopting a cheating strategy. So, two possibilities, and it's mostly important to key in on what's the relative value of S1 versus C in this model. If the overall fitness 1 minus C is a value that's less than 1 minus S1, then at all these frequencies of cheaters, it matters what their fitness is. And they can either, so their only fate is to go to a mixed equilibrium because they cannot displace the cooperators, okay? So they go to some mixed equilibrium, a mixed ESS, and we showed that in the paper, but the more interesting result is when cheating is a pure ESS, and that would occur if you have cheaters that don't pay much of a cost for cheating. and they can displace the cooperators. So no matter what their initial frequency is, it can invade because all of these values lie above a value of 1. And then here on the end, it's not really shown in this diagram, that sort of instantaneously, as soon as everybody is cheating, their fitness falls below 1. Okay? So game theorists find that interesting because it reinforces the evolution of irrational behavior. And explicitly in the system, we were able to manipulate what is the relative frequency of the defector or the cheater phage relative to the wild type. And here's the fitness plotted on this axis. So these are real data. Well, they're pretty noisy. But the point is it has the expected decreasing function. And if you set this end of the regression to the intercept, you can easily solve for S2. Here, we had to do more experiments because the ratio that you have at this intercept is 1 minus C over 1 minus S1. I won't go into all of those experiments. You can look at the paper if you want. But it allowed us to fill in the entire matrix. And intriguingly, that means that they have evolved to a fitness that is less than the ancestor. When they take over the environment, and they are only interacting with themselves regardless of whether co-infection is occurring. Okay? Somewhat sense? Nicole? I thought that was the easy part. Okay. So what the hell's going on in the system? Here's a graph from the 98 paper where the only thing you have to know is here's the fitness of the entire population, which is composed of cheaters and any other genotypes that are in there, through time. And what it's showing you is that they are increasing in fitness in a high MOI environment, but the trade-off is increasingly felt of poor performance in a low MOI environment. So that should be consistent with cheaters sweeping through. You can go in and do whole genome sequencing at all these slices of time in the fossil record. I'm not showing you all the results of that because I only want to show you the smoking gun. Okay? So the wild type at this particular allele position on the medium segment was present until you start to get this big trade-off, and then you find that the population is enriched instead for this candidate cheater allele, a T to C substitution. But just to prove that experiments are just mind-bogglingly complex, even in a virus, it's in a non-coding region. Okay? So here it is relative to that map I showed you. It's in between gene 10 and gene 6, which are both important in attachment to the host and as well as exit to the from the host. Now, what I'll try and finish up with here quickly is that using that higher throughput, faster method, can we see that the mutated M segment alone, the smoking gun in this allele, even though it's in a non-coding region, does it cause the fitness cost at low MOI? If you do a 96-well plate experiment and you only allow low MOI infection, it's possible you can see that. Here's the evidence. So again, only a low MOI environment, you can track bacterial density, just sort of ignore that blip, please. The wild type does very well. So this red curve is much more displaced to the left in terms of the peak, and the extinction time is sooner for the wild type virus than the bacteria. And there's a later peak, and the infected bacteria are experiencing a later time to extinction when the cheater has an entire genotype is in there in the well. But that doesn't tell you anything yet about what is the importance of the individual segments. So you can then separate out those segments into different backgrounds of the wild type and look at them in isolation. And it's only here where you get the medium segment on its own shows any poor growth on the bacteria. In fact, it's even measurably worse than the cheater itself, interestingly. So it seems as if the medium segment is indeed the culprit. The question is, why would you get that in a non-coding region?
Is there, in the non-coding region, is there any interesting nucleic acid structure?
Unfortunately, I think the non-coding region is actually a poor historical annotation. Yeah. And it's probably an extension of gene 10, probably. Or it's a completely uncharacterized gene. So that's one detriment of working in a model system where there's only 3 labs on the planet that are working in. It's sort of the opposite of what we do with VSP, where everything has been worked out for us for decades. Okay, so is this segment itself driving the cheating phenomenon? Yes, it appears to be that way. And since this is, there's a lot of influenza people in the crowd, I'm intrigued by the possibility that this could also happen in any segmented virus, especially those of pathogenic significance, such as influenza. But I'll be happy to talk about that offline. So here's what we think is going on. This relates to Andrew's question the other day about how is influenza packaged up, and apparently that's not fully worked out. We think we have a good model for how segments of 5-6 are packaged up inside of the cell. So there's this empty procapsid shell structure created, and there's an initial affinity for the S segment, the small segment, to get in, and then somehow this changes so that the affinity is for the medium segment to get in, and so on. It has a full genome content that will fit inside of the procapsid and becomes a mature virion. And all that would really be needed is for a greater packaging affinity, somehow the mutated M segment, to get into protein shells that it did not instruct the cell to create. Okay? And Lynn and I will say, actually mentioned that in a 2003 paper, but typical for Lynn and me, we had zero evidence for it. So now it's kind of satisfying that we have better evidence that the M segment alone seems to be driving the phenomenon, and it seems to be the mechanism at play. Okay, so how that could be non-coding could be that here at the end, at the end of each segment, there is the affinity, the PAC region, for the segment to be recognized by the procapsid. But this is single-stranded RNA, whereas this is double. At least it's possible, I have no idea if it's really the case, whether this secondary structure can somehow interact with this allele that's somewhat close by, but not that close by. And that's a very hand-waving thing to suggest, but to me it's possible that some change here, even though it's in a non-coding region, could have the entire explanation through sort of a structural phenomenon. Okay? Okay, moving on. Any questions before I get to the life history trade-off that is often claimed to be universal, but not always are people able to measure it, and that is the trade-off between survival and reproduction. Okay? So the thought is that biological systems, however you want to define survival and reproduction, have a difficult time achieving both in a maximal way. So we came up with a ridiculously easy environmental perturbation assay in the lab to study phage survival. You literally can take a test tube full of phage, subject it to some environmental perturbation, even if it's only 5 minutes long, enumerate them before and after, and you can come up with a very easy measurement of the percent of survivors. Now, importantly, these are the survivors who can plaque, right? Those are the ones that could contribute to the growth of the population, and we're not seeing any of the dead ones. Those are, by definition, non-survivors. Okay, so here's a reaction curve, reaction norm for the wild type at various temperatures when you expose them to 5 minutes of incubation at each of these temperatures. So they can actually withstand heat for at least 5 minutes. That's much higher than the typical time that we grow them in the laboratory. That in itself, I think, is kind of interesting. But then they quickly will become non-functional and they cannot survive at a very high rate or a very high level when you reach, say, 50 degrees. So if we choose those very extreme environments, and several individuals who have worked with me in the past, my student Daniel Goldhill, two former postdocs, Rob and Brandon, they did experiments like this where you basically can crank the virus population through this scenario where you heat shock them and let them grow under normal conditions for a very short period of time. In this system, this would only be 10 days, 50 generations. And you're always sort of looking only at the virus evolution, only the phage evolution, and not the host, because we replenish with naive hosts all the time. So there's no co-evolution in these experiments. At the end of such an experiment, as we showed in 2012 in one paper, you get, even though you're selecting way out here for heat shock at 50 C, you do get some impressive increase and statistically significant increase for the lineages that were exposed to heat shock and not those that were exposed to a mock heat shock, but it's not very impressive. However, back here under more moderate heat, you get nearly 100% survival for many of these lineages. So that's kind of a neat kind of environmental robustness effect. Quickly looking at this in many different experiments with different starting points, actually, this is published now, I should have put submitted. We very often see that there is a base substitution, amino acid substitution, on the S segment in the lysin gene. that governs high fitness under heat shock, the ability to better withstand heat shock in the system. And it's in the lysine. So another wacky quirk of 5.6 is that it has this protein shell that houses the RNA, and coating the shell is an enzyme that it carries around with it and lets it get in and ultimately out of the cell. And then on top of that is the envelope with these spike proteins that allow cell attachment. So not all viruses carry around an enzyme, and my point is that this one does. Okay, so that lytic enzyme, just a little more diagrammatically for you, the virus attaches to the protein phyllis on the bacteria, it's drawn in, fuses with the envelope, gets in, ultimately with the action of that enzyme, and it'll coat itself to get out as well, so it's obviously something that's essential. Okay, so we teamed up with a structural biology lab, Yorgo Modis's lab, because the enzyme had not been determined for its structure, and the region affected by the mutation here is shown in red. And then especially Yorgo's lab did a bunch of experiments on, first X-ray crystallography, and then stability and activity assays. So the circular dichroism I'll show you in a moment, but this amino acid substitution in a classic way fills a hydrophobic pocket. And you'd expect that to better stabilize a protein, and in this case an enzyme, because it's filling the pocket. So it's a very nice and clean story in terms of why that should be a strongly favored mutation. Because Katya mentioned Kate Winslet the other day, now I'll have to try and show some relevance for showing Kate's picture here. She talked about R sub zero, and the intriguing thing that we saw about those mutants and all those experiments, as soon as they got that heat shock protective mutation, they took on a very weird plaque morphology. They produce what are called bullseye plaques. So these are the wild-type plaques where they just sort of epidemiologically clear out a portion of the lawn because they have a strong R sub zero. Each individual virus will give rise to further infected cells. But that must be happening less so for these mutants. Why? Because these plaques are rather turbid, it means that there are bacteria that are not being killed. And weirdly, there's this zone of killing, and then a zone of less killing, and then a zone of killing, and then a zone of less killing. And why should that be? Already, we could claim that it's an antagonistically pleiotropic allele. So I'm emphasizing it's only one mutation away from the wild type. It allows better thermal tolerance, but it must worsen growth. Otherwise, it wouldn't be forming plaques that way. Here's further evidence that it is indeed worsening growth under normal conditions. These are the data I showed you before, emphasizing that it has increased survival at a range of temperatures after this experiment. But the selective coefficient, the negative selective coefficient here is quite large for its poor growth under normal conditions. Okay? Everybody with me on that?
Yeah. So if you, this is probably a harder experiment, but if you grow the bacteria at higher temperatures slightly, do you see a bullseye pattern?
Can't do it. Yeah. The bacteria will only withstand growth at about 27, 28 degrees. So people often ask me that. And there are other related bacteria that we could examine where the growth of the bacteria is okay at a higher temperature. And we're interested in doing that.
Presumably, a wild type may not perform as well in its own
cloud
itself. Right?
Yeah, I mean,
the bacteria and then the virus, you're kind of like one or the other is kind of messed up.
Think of it this way, which is allowing me to kind of riff on your question without answering it, is that we have isolated these phages from leaves, okay? And leaves, under some sunny conditions, can reach a very high temperature. So what we're very interested in is, in sunny environments, in a field plot that we have, are those cystoviruses, these 5.6 viruses, enriched at this locus, the P5 locus? It's a possibility, right? Now we have enough in vitro data to make a prediction about what you would see in a natural community of viruses, which I will tell you is not that easy to achieve and virtually unheard of in phage biology outside of the ocean. Okay, and even in the ocean, that's kind of a part of the environment to do experiments in. So I see, yeah. Okay. Fortunately, there was a paper that preceded ours that related very closely to it and suggests that this should be a typical phenomenon in viruses to experience a trade-off between survival and reproduction. So De Pepe and Tadei had this paper in 2006 where they looked at the growth ability of a bunch of phages that could be grown on E. coli and the log mortality rate, which is sort of the opposite of survival, right? So it's saying that the faster they grow, the faster they die outside of the host, which is consistent with our trade-off that we saw. So they had no idea what environmental conditions caused these viruses to lay on this line at a particular point. But it is, I'm assuming that there's important ecology that causes them to reside there. Our experiment was more about moving closely related viruses up and down the line, okay?
But there's also the component that you have that they didn't about changing environments. Am I missing something?
Well, you mean in their assay that they did not change the environment.
Yeah.
This is not an experimental evolution study. This is a comparative biology study to say, I'm going to take these characterized phage and I'm going to throw them on E. coli and see how they do. And you get a strong correlation.
I mean, maybe I'm being dense. Let me take this offline, but I feel like the classical trade-off is: does the organism want to live longer or reproduce now?
Correct.
And that's a question that can be asked in a constant environment.
Think about it from the standpoint of what they invoked in this paper, is that they did some cool measurements about the density with which the pressure inside of the capsid. So how tightly coiled down is the genetic material. And they found that that correlated very well with if they grow poorly, they tend to have this better condensed genetic material, which presumably better protects against environmental degradation. So you can't achieve both, and it slows your replication as a virus if you have that.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that there should be particular environments where that is more or less important. So if you're in a very low pH environment or a high saline environment, we know that that causes degradation of phages. So if they knew something more about where the SPIAX-174 actually reside, then it might help.
Explain that.
Well, this was known much before this paper. I mean, a lot of antibiotics are targeting fast-growing bacteria. And the survivors, the ones that persist, a lot of times they're slower growers.
I'm unaware of any study that compared phages or any viruses on a single host type. But I agree, it's classic knowledge. But I thought they did a good job of saying a comparative study would take us further. Okay, so again, that's that. Amino acid substitution B207F causes this reproduction survival trade-off. This is a close, I think it's actually a more distant relative. It's still a cystovirus. It's 512, and I don't know if you can make it out, but I mean, these look like rings of Saturn. There's some really weird stuff in just a single lysate of that virus. And I'm very geeked out about the ability to actually show a video. If it works, it does work. So this is a time-lapse video over maybe 18 hours. Of how the plaques form through time for the mutants. And if you have any insight into why this should be happening, tell me, because it's very difficult to figure out a reason why a single point mutation would cause this to occur. And recall that we work with deleterious mutants of this virus all the time, and you never get these phenotypes, okay? So the idea that we have, a working idea that we have no evidence of, because we haven't gone in micro tweezers or anything, is that as the epidemic spreads, that there is the possibility that the virus goes into something called a latent state in the cytoplasm. And there's something about these mutants that they tend to fall into that latent state, and they're in cells that don't die, but they divide normally, and all the cells inherit the virus, until at some point there's a switch back, and the viruses start killing the host and repeat. That's the best idea we've come up with at this point, but if you want to have a mathematical exercise to wrap your head around, try figuring out just plaque growth on a plate, on a three-dimensional, because people have been dabbling with that and not making very much progress, I would say, in the doing, but, you know, for almost 100 years. Okay. I thought I saw it.
Yeah, that's just interesting. It's curious if there's sort of an outgrowth, because there is a some additional.
Yeah, and I'm not showing it here. We see this weird phenomenon where when 5-6 makes plaques, if the epicenters start close enough together, you get a dumbbell. If they're far enough apart, you get a zone that is like a surface where they won't encroach on each other. And that's the same genotype. So I don't know, again, very much about plaque growth and how to mathematically describe it, but nobody else does either. I see dark inner circle here, one ring, darkness of death, another ring, and then more foam.
And you, do you also see another ring?
Yeah,
out in Milan.
Where? Here?
No, further out.
Here?
You probably can't see it too close.
Yeah.
You would say it's outside the plaque, but in the lawn, there's a halo of white.
Could it be an interference fringe?
Interference, what was the term that you used? I don't want to get
to inhibition. Inhibition.
It's bizarre.
So, can you sample? I don't know enough about flex. Can you sample and deep sequence and see? And is it possible? How much is known about the host factors and the bacteria that the virus interacts with?
Not a lot in conjunction. So this is I never said what the host is, did I? It's a Pseudomonas syringae pathobar. And it causes halo blight, so it's somewhat of agricultural importance. So people have studied a lot of the host that we use and close relatives of it.
But
in conjunction with this phage, not so much. I'm not sure. Did you ask another question, too?
The deep sequence.
Oh, yeah. So when I was making a joke earlier about micro tweezers, I was actually serious. If we could go in and take points along here, it might be very illuminating on an Illumina run to figure out what is going on here.
Do you think it's a multiplicity of infection?
I don't think so, because we get, and again, this gets back to our poor understanding of plaque growth. In theory, all plaques should have a high multiplicity of infection eventually, if they get large enough, right? There's like greater and greater density of virus in that plaque. And you know, the cells are not growing as quickly, so eventually the MOI condition when you go from the center out to the edge will change. Okay. So it's a further complication of what you asked earlier about the experimental methods and the prior studies. We didn't really know very much about what the methods were. We just used them. Yeah.
So could there be some diffusing inhibitory substance out of the cell lysate that you generate whenever you're high?
It could be, but weirdly it would have to be because of this one mutant causing that. Now there are other mutants in this enzyme that give you the same effect. But again, we work with mutants of this virus all the time and we've never seen this phenomenon outside of mutations of the enzyme.
So I think I just missed this, but relative to the wild type that 27F mutant. You said it causes a life history trade-off between sorrel and so relative to the wild type, does it have increased survival and reduced reproduction?
Yes.
Or that
entirely.
That?
Okay. Yes, that's it in a nutshell. Yeah. Four.
So at a later time, the white ring will remain white, or will it white eventually?
It remains white, as far as I can recall. I might have to head check with my students on that one. I think it does. So eventually the whole lawn just craps out and dies, and you lose any visibility of the plaques if you let them sit around too long.
I just want to say, it looks like the ring grows after you sort of kill that ring. Right? Like, it's like you go past it, and then the ring comes back up from the region of the tail. So it's not like you skip. Like everyone there, it's like they come back.
I agree. So why the hell is that? Right? Yeah. It's very mysterious. Okay, I have to move on. Okay, so just quickly to show you that this is not only a phage phenomenon for survival reproduction trade-offs, I'll just fly through this. We work on many other study systems. I mentioned that one of them is this very well-known molecular virology model, BSV, single-stranded RNA virus, infects horses and other large mammals, and it's transmitted by arthropods. So consider this cartoon. Here's another way that you can get better survival if you had to be selected for it. If you're a lineage that's undergoing generations in a host, and you have some time outside of the host, whether that's just sitting on, you know, this chair, if it's sitting on that banister, whatever, there's some time spent outside of the host, and then repeat. Okay, so then we'll call that an ordinary transmission time. We expect strong selection for reproduction, because that's always, we think, happening in general in viruses, but weak selection for survival relative to this scenario, where you have a lot of time, an extended period of time, sitting on a handrail. So this prolonged transmission should strongly select for reproduction, because we think that's always premium, but it should also strongly select for survival, and can you achieve both? There's been a little bit of theory on this, especially the Cursed Pharaoh stuff that Sebastian and others have looked at. So we did this experiment in VSV, propagating them for 24 hours, which is the typical transmission time, versus 48 hours, where they basically destroy the cell monolayer after about 18 hours, and in a 48-hour transmission cycle, they sit around a very long time. So these are baby hamster kidney cells that have given their lives for research. And we have a paper in press by these two individuals, a former postdoc and a former undergrad, that say you get the same thing. So the VSV, under the typical transmission time, has this survival curve. And here's two, I think this is lineage. These are two lineages in the data from them. Over a time course, when you just force them to sit in a tube without any cells around, and those that have had a history of 48-hour transfer do much better at just sitting around, waiting for cells to come back into the system. But they pay a cost in terms of many metrics that we have measured for how well do they grow. This is just an easy one for me to show you. It's called plaque diameter. You can get plaques of viruses of eukaryotes on tissue culture cells, and you can measure the average diameter of those, and this says that they've undergone less growth. So this is a very flat surface. It's not a three-dimensional one. Okay, so the plaques you see here are literally from viruses exiting the cell and killing neighboring cells in a monolayer or a sheet. Okay, so there's no three-dimensionality to this, and I don't want you to get confused by it. So that's further evidence that you've got this kind of thing going on in other systems. Is it happening in, say, systems where you have the importance of survival by overwintering in insects? Well, the importance of survival is you're sitting in a bird flying between South Africa and Northern Europe. Or the survival is you go up a mountainside and you're experiencing a very different temperature inside or outside of the host. We think that all those phenomena could be important, at least in these two study systems, dengue virus and syphilis virus that we work on. So we're going to start looking at that. The effect of transmission time on survival, you might think of these two scenarios where start first with Hep C. You can have injection drug users that are passing the virus to one another by sharing needles, and the virus has to sit around in needles and wait to be seen in the next host, versus if it would be inside of a host for the entire time and being passed on through sexual intercourse. So rotavirus is, as far as I know, one of the champions for a virus that's able to sit around and infect people normally. So especially in young people, the very bad symptoms from rotavirus can be lethal. And I'm curious about whether there are scenarios where there's increased selection for survival of rotaviruses under some scenarios, not others. And basically, you can look in these pathogenic systems for evidence of what I just showed you. I think Brandon and, I don't know, maybe his current postdoc advisor, Dan Hartle, might be chasing down the Hep C virus question, and that's why I mentioned that. I know at least Brandon's been interested in that for a while. Any questions on that before I move on? No. Limited time left. Okay. So, in the end, so you can go to lunch. Phages can play by the same evolutionary rules as other systems, so that does make them very useful for examining esoteric questions like game theory and prisoner's dilemma. They do experience the so-called classic life history trade-off between survival and reproduction, and ability to maximize both, and I would contend that would be the case in many types of viruses, and I think it would be intriguing to look at many of them. So can compensatory mutations overcome that constraint? I didn't show you any of the data from
easily the longest experiment my group has ever done. Usually we confine our experiments to 10 or 20 days, but I had a student who insisted on doing 140 day experimental evolution, and the answer is yes, but interestingly, the thermal tolerance mutation that comes in is sometimes not V207F, and when it's something else, it has very big downstream effects for what the viruses can achieve with further thermal tolerance when you ratchet up the heat in the environment. Okay, so if they have the V207F, they'll keep climbing up in their thermal tolerance as you turn the heat up in the heat shock over the 140 days, but if they get a different substitution, they won't do that. We're trying to figure out the reasons why some lineages literally were fated to extinction because they didn't make it through the serial passage if they got the wrong mutation. And phage therapy is intriguing. If you think about it in a rational and evolutionary thinking way, you know, I know what I wanted to say. This is in response to what Paul mentioned. I always assumed that we would do these phage therapy experiments in vitro, and then we would struggle with, you know, we got to work in mice. You know, I don't want to work in mice. Mice are expensive and they're smelly, and I just don't want to do it. You know? All the credit in the world to you in the room who work with mice. I actually never considered that you could leapfrog over mice and work on humans if they run out of options. So my postdoc is very interested in setting up like a compassionate care thing at Yale New Haven Hospital where we get other patients like this. The doctors there have told us that, well, you know, they don't see enough of them. So we're trying to broaden our search field, if you will. And if you know, in your own home institutions or hospitals of cases where this might be useful, we're trying to be a lab that will prepare these things and give it a shot. Okay? So let me know about that if you care. And, oh, yes, the people who did the work. None of it was me. In yellow are highlighted the people who did work that contributed to the experiments I showed today. And you'll just have to find your favorite person on the list, including some of the room. Okay. I should say, I have to go to LA this afternoon to meet my family, but I'm coming back on Sunday, and I'll be here for 2 weeks. So if you want to talk to me, catch me before, I don't know, an hour and a half or 2 hours from now. Otherwise, I'm real happy to talk to people downstream. Probably all hungry, not you though.
Are there students that have urgent questions? Lots of urgent questions.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you one small thing. How often is it actually true that these things recognize MDR like proteins? Right? Because you could imagine that if you just look at the lab strains that we have, which is a reasonable number, how many of the phages actually recognize things that are virulence like that?
I think it's underappreciated that phage uses attachment sites, things that are essential.
5-6 does.
5-6. That was what clued us into this, is that I mentioned very briefly to you, we've been doing experimental evolution in 5-6, and it uses its attachment site as a type 4 pilus, the bacteria gotta have to adhere to a leaf. So once we started looking around for other literature-based, you know, anecdotal accounts of that, it's full of it. The literature is full of it. So I think it should be often possible to find phage that will glom on to surface exposed virulence factors, and I didn't talk about a couple of other instances of where we've been panning them and finding them, but I didn't think we would get lucky enough to find that they attach to the thing that is responsible for pumping the antibiotic out of the cell. So you've probably heard of like efflux pump inhibitors and things like that that people are trying to find, but this is a case of a phage doing essentially that for us.
Yeah. So what was your screen if it wasn't, I mean, so it had to attack this bug?
Right, so our initial screen was taking the lake water and putting it on PAO right. So this is a poster child Pseudomonas aeruginosa strain that's used in the clinic all the time. I think that was what Ben first did. And then, I'm kind of blanking a little bit how we came. I think he then went to the med school and got a meeting with a high-level physician there. I told them about this, wanting to set up the compassionate care thing, and then those conversations eventually led to, oh, I actually have a colleague who has a heart infection that we can't control, and he might be willing to have experimental phage therapy. Let me go talk to him. And the physician got back to us and said, indeed, he was willing. Did that answer your question at all, or was it a long soliloquy?
The last part was me
not exactly what I asked.
Okay.
What did you mean? So you lucked out in that it actually attached to this NVR protein.
Yes.
I guess my question was that part of the screen, or was it just really lucky?
It was lucky in the sense of we started to screen, and then he looked further about, well, what are the ramifications of this? Let me take these bacteria that are now growing in the presence of the phage because they've become resistant, and just for kicks, let me see if they're actually doing what we're trying to engineer by changing the antibiotic resistance profile of the bacteria. And they did, and that took them down the path of the efflux.
Oh. So you checked once and you got lucky one out of one time.
Actually, he has found several phage that do something similar to this. I'm just talking about the one that does it best. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure which family is those families. So, let's see.
I just thought, do you think you can evolve the phages to attack just what you want them to attack?
Yes. So we did that with phage PPO1, and I'll just quickly cut. So that was on E. coli 015787. It's a candidate for phage therapy on that pathogen. And we said, okay, it infects it, it does it kind of limply. Let's see if we can get it to improve. And So the answer is yes, we could do that. And when we dabbled around with this phage PPO1 and getting it to experimentally improve it, by evolving it on the candidate pathogen, it did a weird thing that I'm a little jazzed about, but it will bore you. So this is a tailed phage, so it has that like lunar landing thing. And what it did was essentially all the lineages underwent a wholesale deletion of 600 base pairs that make them kind of more trigger happy. They sit down like this more than upright, so that when they bind to the cell, they get right in very quickly. And it enhances their reproduction, and it should enhance their killing efficiency, but it's a one-way street. They've undergone a 600 base pair deletion. But it's an example of how you can take a phage candidate, evolve it, and you have a very unexpected outcome about how it would be a better candidate. And I thought that that was somehow relevant to your question.
All right.
All right.
Thank you again.